duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Hello, Fireside Chatters. Greg Carlwood here, along with my good friend and occasional co-host, Kyle. Hello, Kyle, my man.
Hello, Greg.
Well, let me tell you, last week I took my special lady to this place that served a $65 sundae and a goddamn pint glass, and that was nothing compared to the treat I have for you tonight, people. A genuine nuclear physicist, Stanton Friedman, got his Master's of Science in Physics at the University of Chicago in 1955. For 14 years, he worked for companies like GE, GM, McDonnell Douglas, and Westinghouse on highly advanced and classified programs involving nuclear aircraft, fission and fusion rockets, and various nuclear power plants for use on land and in space. He left the corporate world, appropriately in the 60s, to forge a new path as a researcher and lecturer on flying saucers and ufology, having now lectured before more than 600 colleges and 100 professional groups across all 50 states and around this big crazy rock. He's provided written testimony to congressional hearings, appeared twice at the UN, and now, in what's sure to be the highlight of an impressive career, he joins us on my stupid stoner show, the $65 Sunday of Ufology, Stan. I'm clearly speechless. Thanks a million for being here. How are you?
I think I'm glad to be on.
You know, I hope so, too. But let's get into it. Stan, I really respect intelligence because mine's so limited, as Kyle could probably tell you, but coming off that intro, having been on such a conventional trajectory for a successful young scientist, what led you to break from the mainstream philosophy to reject the idea of alien spacecraft outright and ignore any data associated with it?
Well, it's the reverse. I jumped into looking at data and looked at a lot more data and found a lot of stuff I hadn't known existed and started a lecture. Professional groups responded extremely well to the programs. And when the bottom fell out of the advanced nuclear and space systems business, as it did in 1970, I gave my first lecture in 1967, I went full-time ufologizing, if I can make up a word, and I found that there was enormous public interest, and I've spoken to all those colleges and professional groups, and the thing is, I can't reject the acceptance of the professional community. One of my early talks was at the Engineering Society of Detroit, for example. They were sold out for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk, and there wasn't one negative question. Now, these are not a bunch of nutty guys up there in Detroit. I spoke to the American Nuclear Society section at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and we had over 500 people, no negative questions, very responsive. So I decided, since I'm a ham, I enjoyed being on the stage, and the response was so good. And I worried, you know, the first year or two, is somebody going to say something which throws out everything I thought was true and I'll have to bury my head in the sand? No, it didn't happen that way. As a matter of fact, I found that in over 700 lectures, I've had all of 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk. The audience took care of the other nine. People are interested, excited, responsive, and, you know, one of the problems here is that people really are interested in this subject, and most of them accept some UFOs as alien spacecraft, but they're afraid to admit it.
Right.
There's a laughter curtain that's been erected by the nasty, noisy negativists, the naysaying newsmen, the fossilized physicists. I like alliteration, as you can tell. And what I have tried to do is to take advantage of that, fill the space with facts, data, solid information. In my early lectures especially, I focused on five large-scale scientific studies, and after each one, I was nasty enough to ask, how many people here have read this? And I know that it was fewer than 2% all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So that I know that I'm presenting information that people aren't really aware of, because the popularizers of the negative movements haven't told them about it. So I'm filling a need. I'm replacing the, oh boy, I better not say anything, with, oh, everybody else is interested too. And a good illustration of this, at the end of many of my lectures, I will ask the first question, How many people here believe that they have seen what I would describe as a flying saucer? I've given definitions early in the lecture. And I'll make a joke. You know, we didn't let the CIA in. It's okay. Just raise your hand and I'll point and count. And I start doing that. The hands go up reluctantly. You can tell they just barely get up over their heads, but I'm on a stage. I can see them. By the time I get off to my right, the hands go up proudly. Each person had thought he was the only one. Typically, it's 10%. So yeah. I got 1,000 people out there. That's 100 people who've had sightings. But then I ask the embarrassing question. How many of you reported what you saw? 90% of the hands go down.
Mm-hmm.
And when people come up to my table and they want me to sign their books or whatever, they've got to tell me their story. They got to tell somebody who's not going to laugh at them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's me. I laugh at the nasty, noisy, negative. And I will ask after listening to their story, and I'll say, did you report it? No. Why not? They'd think I was some kind of a nut. That was really the most common answer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to do something about that. And I mention this because a lot of people think that, boy, you must get a hard time. You come on so strong. Because I start every lecture mm-hmm. by saying that I've reached four major conclusions after, gee, now it's, what, 54 years since I began studying ufology,
man.
If you will.
Incredible.
I'm an old guy. My birthday is Sunday. I'll turn 78, and I'm not ashamed of it.
Happy early birthday.
Thank you. Peter Jennings was born on July 29th, and so was Benito Mussolini. In exalted company I am.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I find is that people are interested. They want to do something about it. They don't know how. So I try to fill that void with facts, with data, and I raise all the objections of the nasty, noisy negativists, and I demolish them. I don't ignore them. And you see, the four major conclusions, very straightforward. One, the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. In other words, some, underlined 37 times, some UFOs are really in spacecraft. Most are not. Mm-hmm. I don't care about that.
Well, only one has to be, really.
Well, you know, most people aren't 7 feet tall. A basketball coach says, what do I care? Give me one. You know,
yeah, exactly.
About the ones who aren't. The second conclusion is we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate. A neat turn of phrase, but what I mean is some few people within major governments have known since at least July 1947 that indeed some UFOs are alien spacecraft. You don't keep secrets by telling everybody and hoping nobody will talk.
Mm-hmm.
You release as little information as possible. I worked under security for 14 years. I've been to 20 archives. I know how many zillions of documents there are out there that you don't have access to.
Right.
The third conclusion is there are no good arguments against the first two conclusions. And the fourth conclusion is we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium, visits to planet Earth by alien spacecraft, successful cover-up of the best data, bodies, and wreckage for 65 years now. I was just in Roswell to celebrate the 65th anniversary of the Roswell incident in 1947. There are four problems. When you try to listen to the debunkers, and I don't like to, but I do listen to them
mm-hmm.
so I can refute their arguments, there are four techniques, four rules that they abide by. One, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up.
Right.
Two, what the public doesn't know, I'm not going to tell them. Three, if you can't attack the data, attack the people. It's easier, and nobody will know the difference. And four, do your research by proclamation. Investigation is too much trouble, and who's going to know? And so when you as soon as you recognize these and you keep listening for the signs, one of the biggest debunkers, for example, was a guy named Philip Klass, who wrote several anti-UFO books, senior avionics editor for Aviation Week and Space Technology, the late Philip Klass. And on two different appearances on Larry King, he talked about the book that was under discussion. And one was by Dr. David Jacobs, who specializes in abductions.
Mm-hmm.
And, all those people have mental health problems. Now, Phil was trained in electrical engineering. The foreword to the book was written by Dr. John Mack, a Harvard psychiatrist. You'd think he'd be in a better position to judge. Anyway, halfway through the program, Larry asked him, did you read the book? No. And the same thing happened a second time with a different book. So you learn to be very wary of pronouncements from on high and to make sure that the people have actually looked at the evidence. And one of my pet communities is the SETI community, you know, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Yeah, they're just not doing it right.
Well, frankly, SETI should stand for Silly Effort to Investigate, SETI.
Agreed.
Because based on bad science, they're assuming for some reason that aliens are sending messages to us. Why, I have no idea. And secondly, they're assuming that they're using technology that's appropriate to our technology.
Exactly.
We've had long-distance radio since 1901. Big deal. I mean, there are stars, my favorite stars from which aliens originated on planets around, awkward sentence, but you get the idea. Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli.
Mm-hmm.
It's the constellation of Reticulum. You can't see them from here. You got to go below the equator. These come out of the Betty and Barney Hill story, and there's a whole chapter in the book Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, where myself and Kathleen Marden, who's Betty's niece, has all the hypnosis tapes, all the rest of that. Anyway, those base stars, they're 39.3 light years away, which is just down the street, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
They're only an eighth of a light year apart, which means that 30 times closer to each other than we are to the next star over. So we're out in the boondocks.
Right.
And a little extra detail. They're a cool billion years older than the sun. Now, you think they're stuck with our technology from 111 years ago? You know, that's absurd. When we start looking at the evidence, we find out that none of the arguments stand up. I mean, you can't get here from there. Well, you can't get from Fredericton, New Brunswick, where I live, to Los Angeles in 10 hours on a bicycle.
Right.
Or in a car, but getting the right airplanes, you can do it. Or you get on the space station, it goes around the whole planet in 90 minutes. It took Magellan's ship 3 years to go around the planet back in 1522. And that wasn't that long ago on a cosmic time scale. So, and the kicker here is that I worked on nuclear fission rockets. I think you have a picture of one of them. It says Phoebus on it, toward the bottom. And that was tested in the late 1960s. It was built by Los Alamos, and its big brother, Phoebus 2, I think I sent you the Phoebus 1. The Phoebus 2B, less than 7 feet in diameter, power level 4,400 megawatts. That's twice Hoover Dam, if you want something to compare it to, which is just a little larger than 7 feet in diameter. The exhaust temperature, it uses liquid hydrogen and goes in liquid, comes out very hot gas. Temperature about 4,300 degrees Fahrenheit. And it worked. That's nuclear fission. I worked on a study of nuclear fusion. That's really the exciting kind of propulsion system. Fusion, for people who don't recognize, is the major source of energy throughout the universe. All the stars produce their energy not by burning gas, but by nuclear fusion processes. And it's a little more efficient than burning gas or even than fission. If you use the right stuff in the right way and kick particles out the back end of a fusion rocket that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. And the thing is, it's one of the things about the SETI guys. They never refer to the advanced propulsion systems. They think they'd have to be developed at a university. I had a guy tell me, two guys tell me, frankly, that if Roswell really happened, Stan, they would have had to pull half the physicists out of colleges across the country. And I laughed. I said, you've got to be kidding.
Yeah.
Don't you realize that we got national laboratories like Los Alamos and Oak Ridge and Hanford and Sandia and Lawrence Livermore, and then we got companies like GE and Westinghouse and Lockheed and Boeing and all these guys. There's plenty of guys with appropriate security clearances and very sharp talents out there. You know, the Manhattan Project, it was done in secret. That's the first thing. Some people say it involved as many as 100,000 people. Others say only 60,000. The gaseous diffusion plant at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, used 5% of the electrical power produced in the United States to pump uranium hexafluoride gas through little holes in nickel barriers in order to enrich it in U-235. The plant was a mile long, done in secret, used 5% of the electrical power of the United States. And it was in Tennessee because they had TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority. They produced electricity. And, you know, it was a big project. And when I, well, as an example, I worked on aircraft nuclear propulsion systems, and when I mention that, people look at me, what's he talking about? Worked for General Electric Aircraft Nuclear Propulsion Department, Cincinnati. 1958, we spent $100 million. That was a lot of money for 1958. We employed 3,500 people, of whom 1,100 were engineers and scientists. This wasn't 8 professors and 25 grad students. This is a major undertaking. Would you believe that we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers that can operate for 18 years without refueling?
I read that in the book. That was the first time I had ever heard that. That is crazy.
Well, it is crazy, but I mean, it just illustrates, and this was not done in academia. It was done in industry, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But that's nuclear fission. Now, look at the progression. From 1944, we had 10-ton blockbusters.
Yeah.
That was the name for our biggest bombs, and they weighed 10 tons, like 10 tons of explosive. It made a big hole in the ground, boy, I'll tell you. In 1945, we tested the first atomic bomb. It produced the energy of about 19,000 tons of explosive. And boy, we really went at it in 1952, the first nuclear fusion device, 10 million tons of TNT.
Wow.
That was a 3-mile-wide fireball.
Man, and what? Just imagine, what do you think they're at today?
Well, we know that the Russians tested a bigger one, 57 million tons of explosive energy release equivalent.
Wow.
And fortunately, things have slowed down. We've only tested, people don't realize, we've exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons on this planet. Only 2 of them in anger, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm glad of that. But 2,000 nuclear weapons. And the point of mentioning this is that gets you to one of the key questions. Not just can you get here from there, which you can if you want to spend the money, but why would they come here? Why don't they land on a White House lawn? You know, why don't they sit down for tea or whatever? Let's step back a little and look at those numbers I just gave. We used weapons during the war. World War II, we killed 60 million of our own kind. Some people say 70. I'm very conservative, so I only said 60. You know? And we destroyed 1,700 cities. Now, if you were an alien, would you want us out there? I don't think so.
No, of course not.
And, you know, why come here to make sure we don't go out there? You got to keep tabs on the primitives in the neighborhood, but only close tabs on the primitives to show signs of being able to bother you.
And what better place to do that in 1947 than the Nevada desert? You know, I mean, that's where we were testing a lot of our cutting-edge technology. Am I right?
Well, look, in July 1947, at the time of Roswell, there were 3 signs that any visiting alien would notice that would indicate soon we'd be moving out. Nuclear weapons, powerful rockets, the German V-2s. Our first nuclear weapon test was in 1945 at Trinity Site, which is on the grounds of the White Sands Missile Range, which is where we were testing to capture German rockets, and where we had our best radar, which is the beginning of the electronics revolution, really, just before World War II. And that's where Roswell is, southeastern New Mexico. Now, admittedly, I had a very haughty British astronomer say on a television program, well, they could have gone to the Soviet Union. And he said, no, sorry, they didn't test their first nuclear weapon until 1949. So I can understand them being there. And I can understand their concern with us, and I can understand the military's concern with the aliens. I have personally heard 7 stories of airplanes, military planes, chasing UFOs and not coming back. If I've heard 7 such stories, it would have been a lot more than that. And people don't realize it, but in 1952, the military gave orders. That was a big year for UFO sightings. shoot them down if they don't land when instructed to do so. That's what was said. Those were the orders. It was in the newspapers. And they even named the military officer. And there was an Air Force general who shortly thereafter said, we've scrambled them 300 times. What can I say? There's a lot going on. The Mutual UFO Network, largest UFO group around, has been getting over 600 sighting reports a month for years.
That's a lot of sightings. Something's definitely happening.
Yeah, it is. And the point isn't that I'm saying every UFO sighting is an alien spacecraft. Of course not.
No.
And every isotope of uranium is not fissionable either. So what? You know?
Right. It only takes one. If one is, that's you know, history changing.
Yeah. And that's the thing. And history has been changing. And some people may get a little upset when I say we're a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. But the U.S. just passed a new military budget the other day. $600 billion. You throw in the rest of the planet, and Earthlings will spend approximately $1 trillion this coming year.
That's sad.
And thousands of children die every single day of preventable disease or starvation. That tells you a lot about this planet, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like so many people, you know, would hear what you're saying and feel the exact same way, but it just kind of, in one way, it seems to be outside of our control. You know, there seems to be people who want to operate a certain way, and no matter which leaders we tend to elect, they always, always seem to just want to engage in warfare. It's an unfortunate circumstance.
Yeah. That's how you get votes, isn't it? I'm stronger than their guy.
Apparently so. Now let me ask you about Roswell, because, you know, you reopened the case in 1970, even no one was talking about it. You've done tons of research, still doing it today, probably for 40 years you've been talking about it. But I got to have you walk me through the Roswell case, because there's so much wild speculation that they were Japanese POW experiments, or there were no bodies or crash test dummies. So what does it look like to you, the Roswell case?
Well, there are more crazy stories than you can shake a stick at.
Right.
First of all, we have to recognize that nobody came running to me with the Roswell story. Hey, Stan, I got a good one for you.
Right.
At all. I was in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, at a television station, promoting my lecture that night. This is in 1978. Promoting my lecture that night at Louisiana State University. And I had done two interviews. I was supposed to do a third one at the station, and the reporter was nowhere to be found. No cell phones then, so, you know, how do you find her? Where is she? And the guy, the station manager, was giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch because he knew the people who brought me to the station. He knew I had other things to do. And out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And brilliant investigator that I am, I said, who's he? Oh, he handled wreckage from one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. What? I dropped my teeth, you know. Tell me more. What do you know about him? He lives in Houma, Louisiana. Well, that didn't tell me anything because I didn't know where Houma was.
Right, who does?
I've been there since to talk to Jesse. Anyway, he told me about Jesse, and then the reporter showed up and had a great crowd that night. And the next day from the airport, I was there a bit early, I called information. This is before the internet, you understand.
Right.
Now it's easier. Called information, got a number for Jesse Marcel, talked to him. And he told me his story. Now, he couldn't deny it because, as I found out later, his picture was in newspapers all over the place. The story was all over the place. He could hardly say, oh, I didn't have anything to do with that. Well, you know, there it was in the story. So he told me he was the intelligence officer for the 509th. Now, it's an important thing to recall that the 509th was the most elite military group in the world. Why do I say that? Because they dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, 45, and they dropped two more in Operation Crossroads in 1946. That was out in the Pacific. And so all the officers were handpicked officers, high-level clearances, etc. So he's the intelligence officer. He's the duty officer for the day on Sunday the 6th. They get a call from the sheriff's office that a rancher had come in with some strange wreckage. Now, I should add that we now know there are roughly 1,000 sightings in the June-July time frame that year. Kenneth Arnold's big sighting on June 24th started the ball rolling, so just 2 weeks earlier, roughly. And so the sheriff naturally called the base, as he was supposed to, if there was anything that might involve the base. Nobody was talking about Martians or anything like that. But people were seeing awful strange stuff flying very fast all over the United States and some other countries. And so the sheriff was supposed to call the base. He talked to Jesse. Jesse went and looked at the wreckage that the rancher had brought in, a small amount of what was out on his ranch. He said there was nothing conventional there at all. He'd served in the Pacific. He'd seen airplane crashes. He knew what to expect. And he talks to the base commander, Colonel Blanchard. The boss man says, take the counterintelligence corps guy. That means he was concerned about who's spying on us. He could hide an army in New Mexico, very low population density. And so they go out, they follow the rancher out, they find this debris field, 3/4 of a mile long, a few hundred yards wide, crazy stuff strewn out all over the place, foil-like material mostly, very lightweight, very strong. And what Jesse told me in our first conversation was, there wasn't anything conventional out there. You expect vacuum tubes, you expect wires, you expect tags saying made in Oshkosh on equipment. You know, airplane crashes produce a lot of junk. There wasn't anything like that. And Jesse figured that it had to be a meteor explosion because it covered such a large area and there was no crater. Because if an airplane goes in, you make a big hole in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So they goes back, like each takes some of the wreckage, still leaving most of it out there, go back to town late at night on the 7th, on the 8th at the big meeting, in the morning meeting at the base. The base commander gives two orders. One is to the press guy, Walter Hout, put out a press release saying we picked up one of these saucers that people have been seeing. And the other was to Jesse Marcel, take some of this wreckage with you to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, that's where captured equipment is supposed to go, and make a stop at our headquarters, 8th Air Force in Fort Worth, Texas. So naturally, everybody follows orders, and the press release goes out about noon New Mexico time, which is too late for the East Coast entirely, but not too late for evening papers from Chicago West. And I found copies in the Chicago Daily News, in the San Francisco paper, in the Salt Lake Tribune, and Spokane Chronicle, and Los Angeles Herald Examiner had the original story, and because of the time difference, had the cover-up. General Roger Ramey, head of the 8th Air Force at Fort Worth, says, just the radar reflector weather balloon combination, which is an insult to the intelligence of all the guys in the 509, that they couldn't recognize that.
Of course.
Now, I should add, some people said, oh, but they handed Blanchard his head for putting out that crazy press release. He got four more promotions after that and wound up as a 4-star general and vice chief of staff for the United States Air Force when he died of a massive heart attack at the Pentagon in the mid-60s. He was not punished. Early in July 1947, Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library, Periodicals Department. There was a story confirming what Jesse had said, giving us more names, more information. They spelled Walter Hout's name 4 different ways when you looked at all the papers. But in the next year and a half, we found 62 people connected with the event.
Wow.
And and that was the old-fashioned way, you know, telephone information and stuff, as they're saying, no internet.
Right.
But I was lucky, I'll grant that. I called the Roswell paper once I found out they had one. Asked for the editor from 1947, oh, he's long gone, what do you need? I said, well, I've got this article here that says the base public information officer, a guy named Walter, before I could finish the sentence, says, oh, his wife works here. What?
How convenient.
You don't expect a guy who was born in Chicago, as a matter of fact, who was based in Roswell in 1947 to still be there in 1978, but he was. He had a base yearbook, was a tower of strength, one of the founders of the International UFO Museum, incidentally. A great guy, and I talked to a lot of people about Walter. He was also a bombardier during the war, more than 20 missions, dropping bombs on Japan. dropped the instrument package in one of those two nuclear weapons tests in 1946. You pick your best people to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to stress, these weren't a bunch of nuts. They weren't a bunch of kooks. They were people who had something on the ball, no question.
Right.
And the first book came out in 1980. I got a percentage of Bill Moore's royalties. He worked with Charles Berlitz, whose name was magic with publishers because of the Bermuda Triangle. And we kept at it. By 1985, we had found 92 people. And the research is going on. Of course, most of the people are dead. But if you go to my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, one of the DVDs that's listed is Recollections of Roswell, with first-hand witnesses only, 27 of them. And almost all of them are dead. Not quite all, but almost all
are dead. It's getting to be that time, you know. The human lifespan only lasts so long. But hey, let me ask you, where do the alien bodies come in? You know, where did you start to hear those reports?
There wasn't any talk about bodies back then in 47. But as I started to do the research, I was checking around, who can we talk to in Roswell who might know something? And one of the people that was mentioned was Glenn Dennis, the undertaker. And he's the one who first came up with the body story. And then we had other people tell us the same thing. And he had a telephone call from the base guy who handled funerals and stuff like that, asking about how they could get small caskets. And he said, well, we've got a couple here, 3-footers, 4-footers, you know, like for kids. And we can get you more over in Amarillo, take a day or two and so forth. And was there an accident? Do you need my services? No, I'm just wondering, what would you do to preserve bodies that were found out in the desert? It gets awful hot down there. And Glenn talked about dry ice and told him where they could get it, stuff like that. And when I talked to Glenn, at first he was reluctant to tell me much of anything. And then I sent him a bunch of background material, and so he'd know I wasn't a National Enquirer reporter. And he said, come on up, we'll talk about it. Well, I was with another guy who knew Glenn, drove me up there, and Glenn tells me a story about he dropped an airman off at the base hospital, escorted him in the this may surprise some people, but the funeral service provided the ambulance service. A hearse and an ambulance, not much difference when you get down to it.
Right, splitting hairs.
And he walked in to see a nurse he had some interest in, and when she saw him, you know, get out of here. They're going to give you a hard time. You can't stay here. And the guys there gave him a hard time. Don't you ever say anything in town, et cetera. They escorted him out. The next day he met her for lunch at the officers' club. She was a lieutenant. And she was drafted into service by some doctors that were there who were, I don't want to say they weren't autopsying, but they were cutting up some bodies that were there that stank to high heaven and really got her very upset. She drew a picture for him, what their hands looked like and so forth. And she was pretty upset about the whole thing. And then when he tried to get back to talk to her in a couple of days, she was gone. She'd been shipped out. So since then, we've heard many other stories about bodies. But again, always quietly in the background.
Man, do you think Roswell is the closest we've ever come to a smoking gun?
Well, the Aztec case was just as good. More bodies and more intact craft.
Really?
And that's why I mentioned that book, Aztec Incident. It's listed on the website. And you also get the multiple witness radar visual cases, which are very exciting. When a plane in the sky has a saucer fly around it, especially if it's a reconnaissance bomber, the plane, and they're monitoring it with fancy equipment, and they radio the ground, and the ground radar military picks them up and this object, and this sighting goes on for an hour. Multiple witness radar visual with highly trained people, that's pretty exciting. And then,
right.
Well, there was a case up in the Yukon 31 witnesses who see this monstrous craft, and a civil engineer named Martin Jasek wrote a report on it. He was able to triangulate because there were so many witnesses spread out over quite an area on the ground. And this thing was between half a mile and a mile long.
Jeez.
That's big.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was the Japan Airlines case where the crew of the plane, which was heading toward Fairbanks, Alaska from Iceland, this big old object, twice the size of an aircraft carrier, they said, circled around them. They pick it up on the plane radar. They radio the ground, the military radar there. They pick them up and the object. They get permission to fly in a circle, and this thing station keeps with them. All this being recorded by the guys on the ground. Now, what do you do with a case like that? Well, you cover it up. As a matter of fact, the FAA guy, Callahan, has talked about it. He was told to grab all the paper and all the radar screen information, take it to a meeting in Washington. It was all taken from him, and that was the end of that.
Hmm.
But, you know, these are the guys we're depending on to monitor our skies and so forth. You can't ignore their testimony.
Right. You gotta think they're credible.
Yeah, and then there's the Ted Phillips of Missouri has collected, the last number I heard, about 4,000 physical trace cases from 80 countries where people see a craft on the ground, and after it leaves, one finds physical changes, and one-sixth of the cases involve reports of little beings. And then, of course, you got your abduction cases, like the Betty and Barney Hill case. Incredible story, but the psychiatrist that was involved doing the hypnosis was a world-class expert, Dr. Benjamin Simon, on, today we'd say PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Betty and Barney were each separately went under hypnosis because there was a period of missing time. This is many sessions each separately. And he has in writing said that the emotional intensity as they relived the experience was as great as that of any of the war veterans that he had worked with. He ran a 3,000-bed hospital for shell-shock war veterans.
Man.
So this is a guy who knows what he's talking about. And he had to stop one session each because he wasn't sure they could handle it. You know, blood pressure going up, heart rate going up, terror, pure terror. And they weren't copying anybody because nobody had reported such a case before they did.
Can you give us the details of that case? What did they say that they experienced?
Well, they were driving home from Canada toward Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It was late at night. They spotted this object in the sky, kind of lonely country. I've been up there. As a matter of fact, there'll be a whole anniversary celebration September 14th, 15th, 16th in New Hampshire, Lincoln, New Hampshire. And they spot this thing flying in the sky, and Betty watches it and describes it to Barney. He's driving late at night. And, oh, no, Betty, there aren't any flying saucers. It's probably a Piper Cub. Well, it's moving strangely. Quite strangely, it flew in front of the moon, between them and the moon and stuff like that. And it flew near the Old Man of the Mountain, which was a major monument up there. It's since fallen into the lake. And it was 1.5 times the size of this sort of sculpture, which is 48 feet. So people are trying to identify this as Jupiter. Now, Jupiter doesn't fly in front of the moon, in case nobody realizes that.
Right.
And it certainly isn't 70 feet high, you know, as you're watching a pattern there on the planet. Anyway, they keep driving along, going home, and this thing comes up close to them, less than 200 feet away. Barney gets out of the car with binoculars. He's looking at this thing through the binoculars, through the windows of this round craft up there. He sees about a 10-man crew of sort of strange characters, and he suddenly gets very frightened. Dashes back to the car, tells Barney they're gonna capture us, drives off, does something very strange. He turned from a major highway, Route 3, to a secondary road, to a tertiary road, a dirt road, out in the middle of nowhere. Barney would never have done that.
Yeah.
And they see beings in front of them on the road. It's dark. I've been out there. It really gets dark. And they stop the car, and to make a long story short, they get taken on board the craft, examined in separate rooms, stick a needle here, scrape a little skin there, that sort of thing. Betty had grabbed what she called the book because she didn't know what else to call it. They wouldn't let her take that with them. And one of the interesting parts of the story is Betty would ask anybody anything. She knew who. She was a social worker with the state of New Hampshire. Her family came over in the 1600s. And Barney was black. Betty was white. Barney's grandfather was a slave. Mixed couple. They had nothing to gain by going public and didn't intend to, but somebody betrayed a secret and so forth. Anyway, Betty asked them, typical Betty, "Where are you from? I know you're not from around here," the understatement of the month. "It shows you what I can call a three-dimensional star map or model, probably a hologram. Points of light, which are stars, different kinds of lines between them, which are trade routes or occasional expeditions." And she's looking at this thing about 3 feet by 2 feet by 2 feet. And she said, "Well, where are you on the map?" Wise guy alien says, "Do you know where you are on the map?" "No. How can I tell you where?" "I don't know anything about astronomy," she said. "Well, how can I tell you where I'm from if you don't know where you're at?" End of discussion. Now, Dr. Simon, who was mystified by all this stuff, he didn't know much about flying saucers, he asked her if she can remember what the map looked like, and she says yes. And she drew it only if it was to be drawn accurately. And it's in the book, the first book, The Interrupted Journey, back in the mid-60s by John G. Fuller. Anyway, they get dropped off. There's some strange sounds on the trunk of the car. And they suddenly sort of wake up. They hadn't said anything for 30 miles. Trouble is, they got home 2 hours later than they should have gotten home.
Huh.
And their watches didn't work. And there were a whole bunch of other stuff, which is in the book, captured, which incidentally will be made into a movie if we're lucky. It's been optioned.
Oh, nice.
And my book, Top Secret Magic, has been optioned. That's about the
Majestic 12. The Majestic 12, yeah.
The two titles are Magic Men, M-A-J-I-C, and Betty and Barney. I may be lucky enough, while I'm still alive, to have movies made in two of my books.
Oh, man.
I want Richard Dreyfuss to play me now.
Kippendorf himself, huh?
Yeah. But anyway, the story, they were missing this two-hour period, and it was a couple years later before Barney was developing ulcers. There were other problems. Finally, his doctor says, "I can't do anything more for you, Barney. I think you ought to see Dr. Simon, psychiatrist." And Betty went too, separately. I mean, they separate sessions. And it was only under his very special brand of hypnosis. Like I say, he treated thousands of war veterans. You know, your buddy's head gets blown off next to you. It's a little hard to integrate that back into life. So it was out of the hypnosis sessions and the fact that a reporter got hold of the story and without their permission or approval carried it. They thought they were going to lose their jobs. Betty worked for the state of New Hampshire. Barney worked for the post office, was very active in civil rights. But the last thing he needed, you know, was a story like this going around. And surprisingly, the story was very well received. And then a book got made. John Fuller, outstanding reporter, wrote a book. He also wrote a book, Incident at Exeter, about some events over there. And the story it was a bestseller in many countries. And it set the pace for abduction research. And the thing is, I met Betty and Barney, and Betty many times. Barney died, 4 months after I met them. And she only died 5 years ago, I guess. And fortunately, Kathy Martin, Betty's niece, who did most of the work on the book, has all the audio tapes, the hypnosis sessions and stuff like that. They're scary. I mean, there's powerful emotion involved in the case. And the thing is that there was physical evidence as well, as described in the book. Barney's shoes were all scuffed. He was an immaculate dresser. Could never wear the shoes except for gardening after that. Betty's dress was torn in a couple places. A new dress. And there was some crazy pink stuff on the on the dress. It's been analyzed and very strange, says the chemist.
Really?
But yeah.
Wow, that's evidence. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is evidence. Of course, it was not the next day kind of thing because they didn't know what had happened. But that story is a good, solid story. And, you know, the aliens were humanoid. You'd have recognized they weren't from around here unless you were walking down the street in New York, which, you know, who knows who you're going to see.
And I assume the communication was telepathic?
Well, yes. They made strange noises amongst themselves, but by and large, telepathic. And,
man,
you know, some people don't want to accept that, and some people don't want to accept all kinds of stuff that's true, but I don't know how to do that, so it can't be real, is kind of the attitude. That led to the book Science Was Wrong, incidentally, by Kathleen Marden and myself, because in so many areas of science, there are 14 chapters, each one dealing with an example of important scientists saying stupid things which delayed progress for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a great astronomer in 1903, October, saying, it's eminently clear that man will never fly any distance in any kind of a vehicle, 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight.
Right.
The astronomer Royal saying a year before Sputnik that space travel was utter nonsense. What would be the use of it? Nobody would spend the money. Oh, well. And medical stuff where people said impossible. I like Billy Mitchell, who was an American pilot during the First World War. And after the war was saying that the airplane is going to revolutionize warfare, we'll be sinking ships from the air. And boy, the Secretary of the Navy got very upset like that.
Of course.
And Billy got court-martialed for insubordination for saying ridiculous things. And the epitome of why this is a problem, these attitudes.
Yeah.
On November 29th, 1941, the Army-Navy game was played, and in the program was a picture of the USS Arizona, this huge battleship, and a statement that nobody had ever sunk a battleship from the air. 8 days later was Pearl Harbor, and the USS Arizona sunk. 1,100 guys on board died.
Man. Yeah, people love to say things are impossible right up until the moment they happen. I don't know what that tendency is.
I don't know why, but it's certainly true, and you got to be very careful. I suppose I'm so smart, if this were true, I would know about it, and I don't, so it must not be. Anybody who says it is some kind of a nut. I mean, you know, you run across it.
Let me ask you, how far do you think the government's knowledge of extraterrestrials goes now? Do you buy into any of the theories that there's been official contact, or do you think it's just recovered craft and we're still trying to study it and we really don't know what it is?
Well, I think probably there has been contact. There are two stories about General Eisenhower.
Yes, there are. I've heard those.
There's a guy reporting now, Art Campbell. He talked to crew members of the president's airplane when Ike was supposedly in Georgia, Atlanta, playing golf. You know, I like to play golf, and it's great cover, you'll understand.
Right.
And the plane went in secret to Alamogordo, New Mexico, Holloman Air Force Base. And down the other end of the field was a saucer on the ground, and supposedly Ike met with the guys. Now, Art's done an awful lot of work. He was a school teacher, and he found other witnesses, found other statements. I think he was on the right track. And there's another story about Edwards Air Force Base where the newsman, again, Ike was playing golf down in Palm Springs, and suddenly the newsmen realized they hadn't seen him for a while, and they asked the press secretary, oh, I'll check for you, no problem. He gets back to them, well, he was embarrassed. Ike had been at the dentist. He was under anesthetic, and they didn't want to say anything about that. Somebody might choose to attack at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But everything's okay. Well, Bill Moore, my colleague with whom I worked on the Roswell case, did some checking many years later. He found the wife of the dentist. The dentist was dead. She had no recollection of her husband treating the president. That would seem a little strange.
That's crazy. What do you think, I mean, if those interactions really did happen, what do you think they were talking about? What do you think they looked like? Because I've heard that they were making a deal for technology, to, and then also the government was allowing the extraterrestrials to abduct a certain amount of people. Of course, this is wild speculation, but I mean, I'm sure you've heard some of these stories.
Well, sure I have. And the thing that gets to me is the fact that I mentioned early on that we haven't exploded any nuclear weapons in warfare, even though there have been a bunch of wars. And there's a guy named Robert Hastings and another one named Robert Salas, S-A-L-A-S, who have talked about nukes and UFOs. And it appears that the aliens have a strong interest in nuclear-tipped missiles and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be they don't want to see the place destroyed. You know, maybe they've been stealing goodies here for a long time.
Yeah, mining stuff.
It could be that, this is a penal colony. They dumped all the bad boys and girls here, and that's why we're so nasty to each other. The Australians are very proud of their convict heritage.
I was going to say, yeah. We're just a cosmic Australia.
Well, it could be. So there may have been communication about what the rules of the neighborhood are. I don't know. Obviously, I'm not privy to any of that. People ask me, what are the saucers made out of? Nobody sends me classified reports. I don't have a clearance or anything to know. I'm sorry. Some people think, the city people think, governments can't keep secrets. One of the silliest lines I've ever heard, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, said at a talk at Penn State University that the proof that governments can't keep secrets is look how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia.
Oh,
now, that
was a media sideshow, to distract from real issues. That's why they focus on that.
Seth Shostak of the SETI Institute has also said, well, look how bad a job FEMA did with Katrina. What's that got to do with the NRO, the CIA, the DIA, the NSA, all those alphabet soup agencies?
Right.
They're the ones who keep secrets, not FEMA. And he said, oh, look how bad a job they do with the post office. Well, what's that got to do with national security?
Right. Do you think we're ever going to see public disclosure?
I don't know. Frankly, I believe that if any media group had a Woodward and Bernstein to put their noses to find out what went on with this cosmic Watergate, I think they could do it in a very short time, 6 months. The documents are there. The NSA has released 156 formerly top secret Umbra UFO documents on which you can read one sentence per page. The rest is whited out.
That's just silly.
These are old documents. And the CIA has withheld 50-some top secret Umbra blacked out documents. You can read 5 or 6 words per page, And we also have a statement from a general, Air Force General Carol Bolander, B-O-L-E-N-D-E-R. He was tasked with the job of figuring out what we should do with Project Blue Book. This is in 1969, after the Condon Report came out. He had no previous connection with it. He worked on the Lunar Excursion Module, a good, sharp engineer, incidentally. And he came at it open and clear, and he recommended that Blue Book be closed. But he noted, reports of UFOs which could affect national security are made in accordance with JNAP, Joint Army Navy Air Force Publication 146, or Air Force Manual 55-11, and are not part of the Blue Book system.
Those are probably the most interesting cases.
Well, yeah, and he, 2 paragraphs later, he says, if we close Project Blue Book, the public won't have a place to report UFO sightings. However, as previously noted, reports which could affect national security will continue to be investigated using the procedures established for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nobody's ever been told that, because we've always been told Blue Book was it, folks.
Yeah.
And when we closed Blue Book, we weren't doing anything. Well, I found General Bolander. He's not alive now, but had a conversation with him and indicated, gee, it sounds like you're saying there were 2 separate reporting systems. He said there were. If a saucer goes down the runway at a Strategic Air Command base where nuclear weapons are stored, that's a national security problem.
Mm-hmm.
If my wife and I go out at the driveway and look up and see a saucer flying by, what's the big deal? Happens all the time, So no major group has ever pointed out that this was what was said by a general who was charged with, you know, finding out what's going on. We've been being lied to persistently. Two Roswell reports, one's about 1,000 pages, the other one's a little under 300, are full of baloney. I mean, you could start a delicatessen with that. you know, the notion, my favorite explanation is really the crash test dummies for Roswell. I found the guy whose picture is in the Air Force report, the Roswell report,
mm-hmm.
Case closed, is the one about the dummies. They think we're dummies. The man who was in charge of the crash test dummy program, the airplanes are flying higher and farther, and getting a pilot out of there if something goes wrong with the plane is a problem. And so ejection seats and all that stuff. And you don't want to put pilots in there until you make sure that things work.
Of course.
And he pointed out to me two things. I met with him in person in Albuquerque. He's deceased now, too. He pointed out, look, the dummies were 6 feet tall, 175 pounds, and they were in uniform. The uniform was because a pilot would be in uniform, and that would affect the drag and how quickly the parachute would open and the temperature, because it's pretty mm-hmm, cold mm-hmm. up there at 40,000 feet, et cetera. And how do you convert a 6 feet tall, 175-pound dummy into a little 4.5-foot-tall guy with a big head?
It's a fair point.
I can't believe any rancher out in the desert there spotting one of the dummies would have said, oh my God, an alien invasion! It makes no sense at all.
Right.
And you know, incidentally, there was another little problem. None were dropped until 6 years after Roswell.
Yeah, that'll be a problem with that explanation.
Time travel for crash test dummies.
Let me ask you another question. You know, lately the UFO community, I see a lot more people, like my last guest, Nick Redfern, suggesting that these things may be more paranormal or multidimensional or even spiritual rather than like physical metal crafts from outer space. Do you entertain any similar ideas, or do you think they're all physical craft?
Well, I would draw a compromise there. It would amaze me if an advanced technological civilization wasn't able to use telepathy and know about reincarnation and be able to do crazy things like go through walls without breaking the walls. You know, by advanced technology, by definition, as Arthur Clarke once said, is magic.
Yeah.
Not M-A-J-I-C. Mm-hmm. So I would expect that they are going to know things we don't know. My mantra is that technological progress comes from doing things differently in an unpredictable way. So I would be astonished if a truly advanced civilization able to get here wasn't capable of doing magical things.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say there won't be time travel. I don't know how to do it.
Right.
Fourth dimensional space-time warping. But I think the problem is that our contemporary people are unwilling to open up their minds to the fact that, my goodness, there could be beings out there that are a billion years ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, do we feel stupid. You know, which is a natural feeling, I guess. Remember, we're right at the center of a change in our attitude about where we fit in the scheme of things.
Mm-hmm.
First, there was Ptolemy, who said the Earth was the center of the universe. All you got to do is look, and you'll see the moon and the sun go around the Earth, and so do the stars. Go outside some night, and you see, they go around us. Then Copernicus came along in 1543, the same year he died. He had a book published in which he said that, sorry, the Earth and the other planets go around the sun. And the church banned that book for 300 years. Because it took man out of the center of the universe. But we still consoled ourselves with, well, there aren't any other planets out there, so we're probably it, folks. Ha ha, we're the kings of the universe. Well, now we've got Kepler up there, and oh my goodness. We now think that a reasonable number for the number of planets in our galaxy, just the Milky Way, is maybe 10 billion. The SETI guys think that a few years ago Frank Drake was saying, oh, there might be as many as 10,000 places in the galaxy that could send signals. Well, 10 billion is a little bit more than 10,000.
Right.
And so suddenly we recognize that the Earth was not created in 4004 B.C., as some people would have us believe. It was more like 4 billion in 4 B.C. Mm-hmm. Our status, in other words, we're not at the top of the heap. We haven't qualified for kindergarten. And that makes some people very upset. But look, Pat Robertson has loudly and clearly said, we are the only intelligent life in the universe.
Right.
All this UFO Pat stuff Robinson. Is the work of the devil.
He's done it. He's the authority. He's done his research.
Oh, yes. 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 Research by proclamation.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with some troubling questions. And also, if there's somebody coming here from someplace else, they have maybe figured out how to get along with their neighbors. We don't seem to be very good at it, do we?
Right. Clearly a problem for us.
And people say, why don't they talk to us? And my offhand, silly comment is, I don't talk to the squirrels in my backyard.
Yeah, exactly. You don't stop on the highway to check out what an anthill's doing. That makes sense to me. Stan, let me ask you another question. I mean, this is completely unrelated, but I just don't know the next time that I'm going to speak to a nuclear physicist. There's a lot of conspiracy talk about a cover-up in regards to how much damage the Fukushima disaster really caused. I mean,
yes.
From your knowledge, do you think there's really any real concerns of radiation reaching the west coast of North America, or is it just a bunch of fear-mongering? Because, it seems like they're hiding data in some sense.
There's no question that the Japanese authorities had been somewhat negligent in how they handled things. Let me put it that way. There's also no question that there will be some radiation, some particles with radiation on them, reach the West Coast. Just as we had plenty of stuff from nuclear fallout when we tested nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy milk in Rochester, New York that had measurable radiation.
Jeez.
Now, the kicker here is that man developed as a species on a planet that was even more radioactive than it is now. Well, most of us forget that if you sleep in the same bed with somebody for a year, you get a measurable dose of radiation.
Mm-hmm.
Our measuring techniques are very sensitive. And so there's even a lot of work that shows that a small amount of radiation is beneficial. This is called hormesis. Two aspirin will cure your headache. 30 would probably kill you. Someplace in between,
Yeah.
This is an appropriate and optimum level. So I've worked around radiation, and you develop a healthy respect for it, but you also recognize, there's a classic case in Taiwan. Two buildings built at about the same time, big apartment buildings. One, unfortunately, the steel somehow had been contaminated by some cobalt, radioactive cobalt 60 was mixed in the mess, and it was years before they found this out. And so then they did some checking as to the medical status of the people who'd been in these two buildings, very close to each other, but separate. Turns out the people who were in the building that had the radioactive steel were healthier than the people who were in the other building. And there have been experiments done with multiplication of bacteria and stuff, where you put in shielding so you cut back the radiation levels. And the growth rate is less when there was no radiation. Seems to maybe affect the immune system. Who knows? So I don't doubt that some of the material coming to the coast of North America has got a measurable, because we've got good instruments, mm-hmm. level of radioactivity. In terms of it being a major threat to the well-being of the people on the West Coast, I don't think so.
Fair.
I'm not running around up and down the beach measuring.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I did want to ask you that because it's so hard to get a straight answer, be it on this or UFOs or, on anything, because the government lies to us so much. But, fellas, it's getting to be that time. Kyle, I mean, was there anything you wanted to ask that we didn't tackle?
I just wanted to say about the cosmic water gate that there's seemingly harmless information that is out there and it is known. Such as nuclear fusion is a reality, and there's devices. I just don't understand why we're still using coal, and I feel like there must be some correlation, there's some connection here between people withholding this information on a need-to-know basis and the rest of humanity who doesn't need to know. They still have to burn coal, they still have to pay for their energy, and isn't it factual that we're past this point technologically, and we just aren't being honest with the public?
Well, it's true that they're not being honest with the public. There's no question about that. This is not the only thing like that. In Flying Saucers and Science, I have a whole chapter on examples of big programs that were covered up. The NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, which is one of the biggest of the black budget agencies, they admitted very quietly, it was a little blurred in the paper, they'd canceled a program with Boeing to improve the architecture of the big satellites that the NRO uses. Some of them cost $500 million. I mean, these are not little toys. And they had already spent $13 billion at Boeing to try to improve the architecture and hadn't been successful. $13 billion is a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know. And they're not the only agency. Well, our first successful spy satellite, the Corona spy satellite, back in the early 60s, got more data on Soviet military establishments than all the U-2 flights that preceded it. There wasn't one word in public for more than 20 years about the Corona. I mean, the Russians certainly knew we were flying them over, but the American people weren't told that. So there are a lot of examples of that, and that's why I say I want a Woodward Bernstein. I don't want all technical data out on the table. I think there is a legitimate national security concern unless the Russians and the Chinese and everybody else puts their technical data out on the table. On the other hand, I think we should be told the planet's being visited and maybe refresh our memory about how we must look to the advanced beings coming here. And it's time, if you make such an announcement, maybe the Queen and the Pope together, how's that for an odd couple? At least you could say there are going to be international conferences about the economic, psychological, religious, impact of the fact that we're not alone. It's a ballgame changer, you know. And I would like to see that happen while I'm still alive. Wouldn't you?
Yes, I would.
Stan, you know, I stand in awe of your accomplishments and your dedicated research. I'm honored just to share a bit of your time, you know. I know all your books and DVDs are available on your website, stantonfriedman.com. Tell the people a little bit about what's available there. I mean, we talked about the books. In terms of DVDs, what do you got?
Well, yeah, the books are Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, Science Was Wrong, both of those are by Kathleen Marden and myself. My book, Flying Saucers and Science, which lists the important sources of information and answers the question, can you get here from there? Yes. Mm-hmm. And why the cover-up and all those other things. There's my book, Top Secret Magic, about the Majestic 12 documents, of which more than 100, I think, three are genuine and the most important classified documents leaked to the public.
Mm-hmm.
There's my book, Crash at Corona. There we go again with Corona. The inside story of the Roswell incident that goes way back to the 90s. And there's a book, Aliens and UFOs, which I have two chapters in and Kathleen has one in. The DVDs include Recollections of Roswell, first-hand testimony from 27 first-hand witnesses. There's my DVD, UFOs Are Real, and there's Flying Saucers Are Real, and there's Do You Believe in Magic, M-A-J-I-C in this case, and there's a debate, are flying saucers real, between me and James Magaha, an Air Force, former Air Force pilot, who says, ain't nothing to flying saucers, and we had a formal debate in middle Tennessee State, and you can decide for yourself who won. There's also copies of some hard-to-get documents, like the Project Blue Book Special Report 14, biggest study ever done for the Air Force, never mentioned by the noisy negativists, of course.
Right.
And there's this book, Aztec, yes, for which I wrote the foreword, so I'm selling copies. One thing, by buying your books from me, you get signatures, you get autographs.
I wish I would have done that.
Yeah, Amazon's a fine place to do business, but they don't have my autograph sitting around
right
there. So, you know, it'll keep you busy for a while if you're interested.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I encourage everyone to check out those books. I mean, I know me and Kyle, we just read Flying Saucers and Science. A really good book. You know, it really breaks down the data that's there that, you know, is overwhelming, that there's clearly a lie being told. It's just, it sucks that the problem is to what degree, because, you know, you let crazies run wild, and you got people on the Disclosure Project saying that they found 57 different races, and they call them the Heinz 57, yeah. And you're like, oh, why are you the only guy who knows about that? But, you know, it sucks.
Good question.
But, I mean, I guess it's time we put old Yeller down, gentlemen. Stanton, sir, it's been an absolute pleasure. Keep doing what you do.
I'm going to cry, and thanks for having me.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Have a good day, sir.
Thank you, Stan.
Wow. What the fuck, Kyle? I can't believe we just did that. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, man, Kyle here, he runs the Facebook page for Conspiracies. Please, if you want to see harsh truths and interesting speculation in your news feed, give it a like. He does an excellent job. Seriously. So that's the coolest shit I see all day is that page. So thank you for doing that.
Yes, I steal every image from everyone else on the internet, so thank them as well.
Yeah, it's the American way. Well, what'd you think of that? Do you think that went pretty well?
The guy's an expert. He's definitely talked with a lot of dead people, and he's been doing it a long time. So I guess when you're 78 years old, that goes with the territory.
Yeah. God, it's sad because, Nick Redfern pointed out in the last episode, I just think people are going to die out, and there's not going to be anyone who knows, and all the documents are redacted, and, the secrets are going to die, and it sucks. As further we get away from it, you know, it gets away from us.
Yeah, but it's not just the UFO thing that there's a cosmic water gate. There's just a huge wealth of information that is withheld from the public on every single level.
Mm-hmm.
And the people are starting to realize it, I hope. And
yeah, I mean, the question you asked, Stanley actually does say in the book a little bit that the implications of the technologies you're talking about would be cataclysmic to the economy. And so they're just not instituted. And I agree with you. I mean, I know you were kind of going at that angle that it's for the greed of elitists, that they're just going to take advantage of us on primitive systems, while they may, and I'm not convinced that they've instituted these systems for their own use. Like, I'm not sure Henry Kissinger's house runs on free energy, but, you know, in his day, they were working on nuclear weapons, and I think today they're working on energy. And I think that there's probably been advances that, you know, we can't even fathom. I mean, you look at what we publicly have seen just with phones and the internet in our lifetime. Think about what we don't know. They're probably two generations ahead, and just that's insane.
Yeah, it's impossible to know what they actually have. I mean, yeah. Stan is talking about nuclear submarines. When people think of nuclear power, they think of giant Fukushima-like reactors, these mm-hmm. huge installations. And what Stan is talking about is in the 50s having naval submersibles that are running off of nuclear fission or fusion, essentially. And the implications of that is that a very small device could be used to run things on seemingly endless energy, and mm-hmm. instead what we're doing is burning coal and paying bills.
Fair. I mean, but the question is, though, is it safe? Because, you know, we've only had a few disasters, and they really are cataclysmic. So is it a safe technology? I mean, I don't know enough about it. I mean, Stan clearly thinks it is. I mean, it's interesting that he's worked so closely with it, and he doesn't have cancer. I mean, it's just an interesting thing to me, because it seems like the ideas behind it are that it's so dangerous, you can't even get fucking close to it. But, I mean, I'm sure he's taken his precautions, but it's been a big part of his life.
I thought it was a very strange answer when you asked about Fukushima, that he said a certain amount of radiation was beneficial to mankind. I highly doubt that a nuclear disaster is going to have a net benefit to humanity, but, well, I guess it remains to be seen.
Fair. Thanks again for coming on the show. That was a great opportunity. We talked to a guy who's just done so much in his lifetime. You know, you're welcome, folks. I gotta say, here's a track. It's a favorite of mine. Watchtower by Heist Click to play us out into the infinite abyss. Kyle, thanks again.
Thank you.
Higher Side Chatters, you are fucking welcome. With the renegades, castaways, outlaws to the game like Thomas Paine was. They masquerade us. Who's the
bombs now set to explode like a hand grenade does. No peace to cease the police to show peace. Unleash beef, no release peace. Underneath the beast that lies dormant, forced to use force, taught to use caution. Tossed to the ground with the subliminal blinded, like KRS-One, cause I'm criminal minded. I run with soldiers amongst the vultures, now you're under control, cause you did what they told you. The front lines now, we're living a battle. Slowly I walk through the valley of shadow, and there's no man that's gonna keep me down. To the thief, to the king, when he snaps the crown.
Speech, so I'm using it well. There's no heaven on earth, so I'm bringing the hell.